We're an academic journal that's dedicated towards bringing a radical analysis of political economy within African countries. My name is Laura Mann, and I'm going to be the chair for this event. I imagine most people in the audience have a good sense of Sudan, but in case you don't and you're new to being interested in Sudan, about a year ago, a coalition of social forces occupied major cities within Sudan and overthrew the 30-year regime of Omar al-Bashir. And since that year, has been under a transitional government composed of half civilian members and half military members. So in the event today, we're going to be talking about what has happened over the course of the last year in terms of the political transition, and also how the global economic and health crisis is putting pressure on the political transition. So I'm delighted to have a panel of four. So first of all, we have Magdi El-Ghazouli, who is a researcher and a fellow of the Rift Valley Institute, who writes regularly on Sudanese affairs on his blog, Still Sudan. Then we have Salma Abdallah, who's a political scientist whose research focuses on the relationship between religion, politics, and violence. But her PhD was about social policy and Zakat, so I'm going to be asking her to talk a little bit about social policy in the context of the transition. Third up, we have Zuhair Bashar, who is a freelance researcher and consultant with extensive experience in conflict resolution and reconciliation at the grassroots level and regional initiatives. And finally, we have Khalud Khair, who's a British Sudanese political commentator and managing partner of Insight Strategy Partners, which is a think and do tank based in Khartoum. And through this, she's been working state and nation building throughout the transition period. So our fourth and final speaker is Khalud Khair. And I asked her if she could speak about how the current crisis might be shaping the balance of power between the civilian and military sides of the government. Khalud?
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Rope. Thank you, Laura, for inviting me here this evening. I will be speaking briefly on the balance of power between the civilian and military components of the transitional government. Power is largely perception. The COVID pandemic was at first an opportunity to address the balance of power. Then it became a magnifying glass to the transitional government's already existing challenges. At the beginning of the pandemic, we saw the transitional government operating not as a group of technocrats, but as a cohesive government, pulling the levers of state power in a way that demonstrated ownership of that seat of power. What we had been seeing before, and to some extent still see, is a hesitancy to act, to make the promise of the revolution bear fruit. I think this is chiefly due to the multifactional aspect of the current governance model. The transitional government is often labeled a civilian-military hybrid, but I think that intimates a level of synergy, a harmonious power sharing between different parts that's not really borne out. I found it helpful to view the governance model as chimeric, after the Greek mythological creature that has three distinct parts: a lion's head, a goat's body, and a snake's tail. Which part of the government is the head is often dependent on the issue at hand. But more often than not, we're seeing the military elements much more in charge. We also have to remember that there are not only two or three different parts of this government, but several dynamic pieces: the Forces for Freedom and Change, individual ministers, the Sudan Armed Forces, the RSF, and the oligarchs, or Jalaba, who have an inordinate amount of influence. In many ways, the government can seem as disparate as the political parties that created it. Each ministry tends to work in silos, and interministerial coordination has definitely been a challenge. Connections to the revolutionary constituents, such as, for example, the resistance committees, is somewhat tenuous and not very well maintained. But the source of power of the civilian part of the broader government does not come from alliances with the military, nor through the chaotic FFC, but through the continued support of the resistance committees. The government has to remember not to take that for granted. The civilian government's key challenges to pulling power in their favor, from a governance standpoint, can be summarized as follows. First, as a technocratic government, the transitional government on the civilian side, and here I'm talking about the ministerial side, has no unifying ideological framework and no well-articulated political mandate that covers the whole of government. The way that the government was structured was to contain various officials who are partisan, but apolitical or technocratic. What I mean by this is that they have party allegiances, but may not behave as politicians do, with a view towards public opinion and securing popularity for policies and visions. This means that governance decisions can more easily be taken mechanically rather than through a wish to govern by consent, and thereby cultivate a level of trust between citizen and state that has been sorely missing. People don't necessarily know what this government stands for. And we have to bear in mind that political parties in Sudan have always been better at articulating what they're against rather than what they're for. In addition to the feeling of limbo brought about by lockdown measures, there is a sense of an acceleration into a political cliff edge. And the absence of this unifying framework is compounded by issue number two. That is, the government lacks a whole of government policy-making mechanism or body. At the outset of the transitional government taking office, a transitional framework was drafted with 10 priorities, such as peace, economic recovery, and inclusion. So far, not enough progress has been made, and the perceived hesitation of the government to institute longer-term policies related to service delivery has been a frustration felt by people in the street, none more so than those outside Khartoum, who have been less able to feel the winds of change than those in Khartoum. The lack of a policy body is a glaring gap. It is critical enough for any government, let alone a precariously situated one. So while we have some idea of what kind of changes are needed, we have less of an idea about how those changes are to be made. And the stakes cannot be higher. As Zuhair has pointed out, the same issues that have been plaguing the country at independence are some of the same issues we face now. In addition, there are very difficult areas to broach, such as untangling the racket that is the gold mining and wheat production sectors. A policy process at the heart of government can enable government not just to act more decisively, but also weigh up the political risks of more difficult political decisions. Nothing can be changed until it is faced, as James Baldwin reminds us, and robust policy mechanism will help the government face these issues better. The third key challenge is a lack of strategic communications. Where the government has implemented changes, they are not always communicated. There have been many changes, big and small, within ministries that have had varying levels of impact, some encouraging appointments of key figures into prominent roles, and some plans for supporting people during COVID and in the longer term that have not been made as available to the public through target communications. Throughout this pandemic, the Prime Minister has not yet made a nationwide address on the situation since it started, and key information about which hospitals will be prioritizing COVID treatment vis-a-vis other diseases have not been made public. This has led to people feeling that their expectations have not been met and have enabled protests by Islamists, or the previously very frequent comments by Assad al-Mahdi, who has always undermined this revolution and the government from the start, to claim center stage in the public discourse. It's worth noting that the armed forces have these key governance issues figured out. They have, if not a unifying political or ideological framework, then certainly robust planning at the heart of what they do. There's a lot of thought that goes into the interventions made by members of the armed forces, which suggests a policy mechanism, and there is certainly a very robust communication strategy at work. Some of you will have seen that the RSF have a show scheduled on Blue Nile TV called Lekia Watan, for you, O nation, the translation of which sounds quite grand, but they're acting politically. It's clear that they are here to win hearts and minds. Previously, the head of the RSF was quick to publicly give support to doctors after some were attacked at Andurman Hospital, while the Prime Minister remained conspicuously silent on the matter. It's sad to see that the civilian part of the government, which can marshal much more public support, is in some ways being outclassed by the military, and particularly by the deputy head of the Sovereign Council. There are certainly some difficulties related to managing the tensions with the military at the higher level, as well as tensions at the social level with resistance committees. There's a clear and increasing bifurcation between the civilian government and the revolutionary forces and the street as represented by resistance committees and others. The military parts of the government have suffered less from this disintegration of their forces. If anything, their position has been strengthened by the legitimacy that ostensibly sharing power with a still-liked civilian faction brings. This is shifting the balance of power in favor of the armed forces, who are separately able to demonstrate more stability and decision. We have, of course, been here before. The civilian side appears chaotic and is the most consistent, ostensibly patriotic, and well-resourced institution in the country. The army appears as a suitable alternative. The military able to maintain its allure despite its history with the former regime, not just because of its organization, but because it taps into the Sudanese subconscious, which favors hierarchical masculine leadership. To be sure, the civilian government is expected to form a Herculean task of getting Sudan in shape for elections. And while there is much to be done, The balance between delivering fully and maintaining the balance of power with the military is difficult to maintain, especially with the persistence of the same issues that blight every transition. Petty infighting between political parties, obstruction from antagonistic political groups, and of course, the specter of further military rule hanging like the sword of Damocles on the head of the civilian government. The transitional government doesn't really have an articulated, more narrowly defined political constituency, which means it isn't always clear whose favor it is meant to curry. We've seen some closing up between civilian and military leaders, which hasn't been well received by a country still seeking justice for the June 3rd massacre, and those from areas in Sudan that have borne the brunt of the military's past activities. But the lack of narrowly defined constituency is actually an immense open door to be more inclusive and draw mandates from the street. Senior officials in the civilian government of this civilian part of this quite nebulous government need to recognize that their power comes from ground level support and that maintaining that is a top priority. Sudan has arguably been in transition for 64 years. The enduring challenges of national cohesion that Zuhair has just highlighted can at this time be more freely confronted than when a single party takes government. So while many issues do arise from this amalgamated form that the government takes, there are some mitigations that do not rely on the entire dissolution of the governance model. The pact with the military, as challenging as it is, was a necessary compromise in August of last year. And while Sudan's history is working against the civilian government, the key thing to remember is that these governance challenges are not necessarily insurmountable. In any case, the civilian government is the best chance we currently have. What they do require is a change of mindset at the top, from that of a technocrat to that of a politician, and from the traditional party, political party oppositional stance to championing a vision through consultation and policy outreach to different constituents. I'm aware that my time is probably up, so I will hand over back to Laura.
Okay, thank you very much, Khalid. So thank you to all four speakers. So first of all, can I ask Heike, ask your question?
I'm really interested in that. I read a brief note in a South African newspaper actually about former revolutionaries having gotten involved in resistance committees focusing now on how to respond to COVID-19. I'm asking perhaps also a bit from the background of the experience we've had in South Africa over the past couple of months, where in the context of the pandemic, we've seen really quite a resurgence of activism, and activism that's been asking also critical questions. So I'd like to get a bit of an idea what is happening in this context in Sudan.
Okay.
A bit deeper than the brief note that I've read in the Mail and Guardian.
Okay. Baba, I'm going to come back to you for your question about the economy as well, because you asked two questions, but I think that your question was quite similar to Heike's, but maybe you also wanted them to reflect on whether the crisis is also smothering political activism in any way. I will come back to you to ask your question about the economy in the next group. But I also want to call on Gina. You had a question particularly about the role of trade unions. Gina, can you please unmute your microphone?
Yes, here I am. Hey, assalamu alaikum, everybody. I'm interested in trade unions. I'm a member of Unison here in London. And I'm interested to know beyond the, you know, the Sudan Doctors Union, or perhaps even the SPA, what's happening with the trade union movement, or if there is one, in Sudan, and also, what role the British trade unions can play in terms of support and solidarity.
Okay, thank you very much. Nice brief question. So I'm going to open up to all four speakers. Who would like to take these questions on kind of political activism, trade unions, and the current crisis? I'm gonna call on one. Khalid, do you want to?
Laura, I can take one on kind of ground level mobilization. So what we've seen actually is that some of the government's responses to the COVID crisis, which was to hand out food hampers to some of the poorest people in Khartoum as a pilot, and I understand that it's being rolled out into other states, was to use the connections and organization and the momentum of our resistance committees to be able to deliver more effectively and efficiently, if you will. And that has been the kind of, transitional government and ground level, connection and working together that we've been looking for, that we've been looking for the government to kind of tap into. My hope is that going forward, that will continue. However, as I've outlined before, there is a distancing or a bifurcation between the kind of the top level government and these resistance committees, but they still remain the source, if you will, of their power. And this kind of throws in questions about, democracy, what happens after 2022. Democracy is not really having a good time right now globally, but it certainly seems that, right now, there are certain things that are happening on the ground that are quite encouraging. So, one of Arundhati Roy has posited that pandemics are portals, but so too are transitions. And Sudan is going through both of those things at the moment. There's not much imagination at the top about what can and should be left behind and what should be cultivated going forward. But the people who do have more of an idea of this are the ground level workers in unions, in resistance committees. And just as we saw during the sit-in that there were small democratic spaces being eked out and where there were teach-ins and civic education taking place, we are seeing that is still going on somewhat during COVID. There's the hope that momentum will continue. I'm not sure if I've answered the question on trade. I haven't answered the question on trade unions at all, but I will leave that for Meg Deepak.
Yes?
And Laura, I saw something about the COVID-19.
Sure.
Zuhair, yeah. With regard to the transitional government response to the COVID-19, I think in theory they have responded on time and with a lot of procedures, but in practice they have provided very little help to people, especially in the peripheries. For example, I'm talking about my area in Darfur. It was only the people, the activists, that came up with an initiative to donate money and to try to contact their friends, their relatives, whoever they know, to get some kind of help with regard to equipment, PPEs, and masks, and something like that. So I personally involved in this in my area. It is in Eastern Darfur. It's called Adila locality. And we have formed a kind of committee to respond to that. We collected money, we collected this kind of donations, and we send it from Khartoum straight away to our area. So that is the kind of initiative that ongoing in the regions and the areas like Darfur. The same thing has happened in Al-Fashir when people noticed that there's a lot of unclear reasons, deaths of people, and increasing deaths among the civilians. Then people opt to this kind of initiatives to help themselves, but the government couldn't provide something at the time, something tangible with regard to PPEs or even doctors that are not there to help people. On the other hand, with regard to the trade unions, I think the problem in Sudan is the trade unions, as well as the political parties, they look like a superstructures. They are dominated by elites. Most of them are belonging to central northern Sudan, and they are fighting over their own interests rather than the people's interest. And look to the last what has happened to the trade unions, especially the professionals bureau, which is last time people were fighting with each other, and now they are unable to establish a legalized committee that can lead this organization. the organization was able to lead the whole uprising, but when it comes to selecting or electing their own leaders, they just fragmented and they can't agree on something. So that's the problem of Sudan. Thank you.
Thank you. Did you have something to add, Salma?
I wanted to add on the role of the resistance committees or the revolutionaries after the revolution. They basically have replaced the state in many instances, and they started a lot of initiatives and efforts to provide, for example, supplies to families in need, and also during this crisis, bread crisis, there are many neighborhoods who report that the resistance committee or the they are helping the families by bringing bread home and also providing security in the neighborhoods, and also trying to observe whether there are any kind of threats to the revolution. Kind of they're trying also to protect the revolution. Beside these efforts, the resistance committees have also been facing a lot of demonization by the old regime. So there are many cases where they have been described as corrupt, as also that they are more political, or they're interested in power more than, and also kind of stealing the revolution and being delegitimized by some of the people who belong to the old regime. So also the resistance committees are also facing challenges by being demonized by the previous regime. Thank you.
So Heike has come back and said her question is directed towards activism and grassroots mobilization, and whether it has been reimagined. Heike, do you feel that you want to clarify what your question was? Okay.
As I said, I was interested to see how perhaps in the context of what is happening at the grassroots level in the communities, that committees were not only handing out masks or sanitizers, which is what was happened said before, but whether there's perhaps a new idea of resistance from below coming up in the context of this grassroots mobilization.
To what extent is this kind of forms of self-help being politicized and being about the role of the state in that kind of thing? Is you want people to talk a bit more about the politics of these kinds of initiatives?
Yes, a bit more about the politics from below, a politics that is happening on the ground in the communities, rather than perhaps at the top of the government. We've heard quite a bit about the problem of the lack of imagination by the people in the top layers of the transitional government. So I was wondering whether there are perhaps any new ideas happening on the ground, as it were.
Okay, so I'm gonna come to Magdi, whether you could kind of address that point from Heike, and also talk a little bit more about trade unions. Is Magdi still with us?
Getting this. Thank you for the question. That's a really interesting question. It's probably the central question of the events since December 18. What type of new politics is emerging from these old patterns that the two speakers have spoken about very eloquently? And I think the resistance committee is probably the if you like, this is our present to the world. This is our contribution to this world in flame. Or what is it, the title, World on Fire? I think the contribution is this formula, the fact that you can organize politically at neighborhood level with people who before had no exposure to politics in the formal sense. Most of the activists, most of the agents of these resistance committees, a large segment of them haven't really been exposed to party politics in the strict formal sense or in the standard or traditional sense. They are reinventing politics anew for themselves. And their main challenge is the main contradiction that they experienced and the main contradiction that drove the formation of these committees is the trepidations, the problems, the contradictions, the struggles against local government and not against the big authoritarian structures. They had to deal with the petty patriarch around the corner, with the teacher around the corner, with the mosque imam who is part of the Zakat committee, who was part of the structure that defined who got Zakat money and who didn't, who got social welfare and who didn't, who got a security card and who didn't, who got health insurance and who didn't. So the sort of the tentacles of the state at neighborhood level, the place where it really operates in its bigger soft belly, if you like, in Sudan. And I think the achievement of these resistance committees basically is to raise a big question mark around the authority, the credibility, the agency of these patriarchal structures at their neighborhood level, at the place where they meet the everyday life of people. And if you are following these types of politics, you'll see continuous patterns of resistance against locality leaders, locality commissioners, heads of local government, heads of neighborhood, once upon a time they were called popular committees, and these were the Bashir's local government organs. And in many places they seized power, if you like, in a way. They actually took over the functions of the old-time popular committees, and they started doing it their way, if you like. They began delivering, as Selma has explained, they took charge, more or less they nationalized, if you could use that word. They took charge of the local ovens that were local bakeries turning down bread. They took charge of the distribution of gas supply. They took charge of health measures. They determined which mosque to close and which mosque not to close. And they enforced these COVID-19 measures against significant resistance from people who said, no, we want to continue praying. We want to continue using the mosque. And it was the neighborhood committee, the resistance committee that made that decision and enforced it. Now, they can be criticized on many instances, including the fact that they still haven't discovered an internal democracy procedure except open debate. So most of it happens in an open format. People meet wherever they can. Usually it's somebody's house around the corner where they used to sit drinking once upon a time. And they would just discuss it out. They'd have to talk it out until some sort of consensus is reached. An electoral element hasn't entered the committees yet. However, they've started building hierarchies. So there are representations of committees at at least at Khartoum and many other bigger cities. There are now superstructures of these committees. So representatives are sent from the neighborhood to some sort of citywide council, and there is now a citywide council for Khartoum that concluded a historic meeting 3 days ago where they decided that they are going out for a massive protest on 30th June. That decision was not taken place in some sort of party structure. That decision was done by people who sort of elected it wasn't an election in the strict sense, but they named representatives in a citywide committee, and this citywide committee is now challenging central government head on by saying the way that you're doing politics, we don't like it. And of course, the counter argument is, how are you doing a protest in the middle of COVID-19, and this would increase infection rates, etc., etc. However, the COVID-19 measures in a large part are a bit of a bogus, in the sense that they're not as effective as they're supposed to be. To be very honest, where are they imposed? It created a black market in passes to go from one bridge to another or to pass from one town to another. It created a black market in transport between Khartoum and the States. And you can bribe your way from Khartoum up to Halfa if you want and if you have enough money. of course, we need to find the gasoline too, which also requires a bit of bribing and black money, market money. So, but the point is that the COVID-19 measures are enforced very selectively, and the people who are heavily concerned about them, of course, are a segment of society that can afford COVID-19 measures. And this is something that you can see in many other places around the world where people cannot afford these measures. It's not about whether they oppose being healthy or do they want to get sick. It's the fact that they cannot afford these measures. And a large segment of the urban working force, as well as the rural working force, and this includes a large segment of agricultural labor in Sudan, simply cannot afford these measures because they have to work day by day. The government cash transfer program is just a tickle when it comes to the cost of living. And it's less than peanuts. It's supposed to be a bribe, but it's not a bribe that is going to get them anywhere. Now, whether these committees will achieve the final victory and deliver us into a world of socialism is, of course, not. It's very unlikely. But they're telling us something about the future of politics. They're telling us something about what other forms might people invent in the future to challenge political power as it is today. And of course, and this sort of ties into your title, this is all thanks to the big opening sequence of the Egyptian revolution. Now, the biggest model for all this is the failure of the Egyptian revolution. And a lot of what these activists have learned has been learned from that grand failure. Now, one big lesson that most of these activists have in mind continuously is the devastation of the Egyptian revolutionary movement at the hands of Cairo's butcher, and the fact that the civilians and the military can somehow find some sort of way of dealing with each other, especially when it comes to secular forces and these military who think a coalition of that version could work for a country like Sudan. I think that big lesson has settled in wonderfully in Sudan, and people are highly aware of that possibility, and they're very aware of that counter-revolutionary element in an alliance that brings together Saudi Arabia, UAE, a military dictator, and some well-meaning but very, very stupid civilian politicians. So this awareness is at home. This doesn't mean that this is a guarantee of success. This might very well fail, but it definitely fails much more better than 1964. It fails better than 1985. It could be a grand and devastating failure, but it is by all means a much better failure than our previous failures. So the idea that we're cycling in the same thing all the time, I don't ascribe to that. I think there is a learning curve, there's a learning process, and the biggest proof of that learning process is the fact and the existence of this resistance committee. This is the fact that it exists at all is for me a massive inspiration. Thank you very much.
So thank you guys for all of those comments. I'm going to move on now to talk a little bit about the economic context of this, and then we'll have some questions that people have been asking about, like the success and you know, maybe perhaps reasons to be hopeful about the context. I'm going to start off with a question of my own, which is this sense of there's all of these kind of local self-help initiatives going on at the local level. But I suppose in a kind of future context, you would want to have some kind of cross-subsidization across regions. You'd want to have people paying into a system in order to be able to provide services regardless of where people are, not based on sort of local resources being available. I know that one of the critiques of cash transfer programs in other countries is the fact that it's kind of very detached from any other kinds of forms of social policy. You're only giving people cash. It's not necessarily attached to kind of, inequalities in people's existing states, not attached in terms of industrial policy strategy. It's a very kind of technocratic, just give people cash, a kind of very financialized form of social policy. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the revenue base of these kinds of programs? Are they just being funded by donors? Are they being funded through revenue collected at the national level? Are they being funded through taxation? And how are Sudanese people going to build in kind of solidarity when it comes to subsidization of public services in the future as we move forward? So that's my question. Then I have a question from Mohammed El Kandrin. I wrote your name down in a pencil and I can't quite read it. But you had a question about the benevolence of capitalism. Do you want to ask your question, Mohammed, if you're still here? Mohammed El Karim, do you want to unmute your microphone?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Would you like to ask your question?
Yes, I was just thinking more about the whole notion of some of the regional players and actors and the kind of financial contributions they are making. And so I just wanted to ask around the whole concept of benevolence, capitalism, and how, of course, that is also applicable to many, many areas in Africa. But if the speakers see any elements of this applicable to what's happening in Sudan. Of course, the COVID-19 is very pertinent, but I just wanted to lay that as an overview of how the speakers think about that. Thank you.
So when you say regional there, you mean external regional actors, is that right?
Okay. Yes, definitely. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Laura.
You're very welcome. And Baba, you had a question about liberalization of gold and state finances, which I think kind of ties it into my question a little bit about the revenue base moving forward. Are you there, Baba?
Yes, I'm here, Laura.
Okay.
Thank you, Laura, and thanks to the four speakers for excellent, well-articulated insights. My question is to Magdi, and essentially it's about the why and the how of the liberalization of gold. I mean, for example, to break this down, like when you had the liberalization of the oil sector in Nigeria, the downstream, it was essentially to expand the material base of the bourgeois, including through corruption, and you had a spike in the number of billionaires and so on and so forth. But now, within a context of revolution in Sudan and the push for the state to, like what Laura was saying, I mean, fund some programs and the resource base for these, it would also seem logical that it would be under pressures to try expand not just a material base of the bourgeois within the government using the instrumentality of the state, but for funding such programs. But liberalization is very unlikely to do this, or does it do that? And putting it within the broader context of the region and your perspective of, I mean, you spoke Arab neoliberalism and also specifically mentioned Dubai as an example of where the gold gets pushed to, is could it also have to do with economic and extraneous pressures, even if soft pressures, from places like the United Arab Emirates? I mean, so essentially, the whys and the hows of liberalization of gold within the broader context of the political economy of the state, trying to respond within their financial constraints to deliver in quote. Thank you.